Services Finance. Representative Zeros, do we have a quorum? Since we don't have a quorum, we won't proceed with minutes, but we will, for the purposes of getting the meeting started. Welcome to the testifier chair table, Mr. Gottwald. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Do you want us to proceed in light of lack of quorum, or?
Please.
Very good. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Steve Gottwald. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Rural Health Association. We represent, I like to say, we represent the counties outside of the seven county metro, so the 80 other counties in the state of Minnesota, in the area of health care and health.
Mr. Gottwald, for the purposes of the record, I am going to call the meeting to order. We have a quorum. And Representative Pinesman, you've had a chance to take a look at the minutes. And he approves them as amended. All moved. All saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Approved. Please continue.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, with me is our board president, Todd Lemke. He is the pharmacy director at Centricare Health Haynesville. And also with me is Mark Schoenbaum, director of the Minnesota Department of Health's Office of Rural Health and Primary Care. We partner with the Department of Health. Have enjoyed a very close partnership with them in the Rural Health Association. We have over 1,000 members across the state in virtually every aspect of health care, from health education to care delivery, large systems to small clinics. As rural communities in Minnesota pursue that triple aim of higher quality, lower cost health care, and improved health and wellness, they do face a lot of challenges that are unique, that are different from what goes on in urban areas of Minnesota. At the beginning of every two-year cycle, we provide this report to the HHS committees in the Minnesota legislature as a means of kind of setting the framework for what happens in rural areas of our state as you make decisions as committee members. So what do we mean by different? Well, in rural Minnesota, on average, people are older, they have lower income, and they're less healthy than those living in urban areas. And while about half of Minnesotans live in rural areas of our state, only about a sixth of our doctors practice there. So healthcare workforce shortages are a critical issue when we talk about health and healthcare in rural. Rural areas also face an older and shrinking healthcare workforce. A lot of people retiring, closing their doors, or selling out to large systems. And we don't have a lot of healthcare profession students, or enough of them certainly, stepping up to take their place. Rural communities are increasingly diverse. We might not recognize that, but we do have growing numbers of non-English speaking households and foreign-born individuals in many parts of rural Minnesota. And there are fewer more widely dispersed healthcare options in general. So on average, rural Minnesotans are older. The percentage of people 65 and older living in rural is dramatically different. Older people on average, of course, require more health care. They're more dependent on Medicare and Medicaid. And those programs typically pay at or below cost, which puts additional stress on providers and facilities in rural areas. So rural Minnesotans on average are lower income as well. Poverty, of course, is an important indicator of health status at both the county and individual level. Wealth of the community can definitely influence health and health care. Childhood poverty is also a big challenge in rural areas of our state. On average, rural Minnesotans are less healthy. We sometimes think of kind of the Lake Wobegon, where the men are strong, the women are good-looking, and the children are all above average, healthy lifestyle. But the truth is, according to the University of Wisconsin Robert Wood Johnson Foundation studies, the worst health problems were found in rural parts of our state, particularly in north central and northeastern Minnesota. Here's a list of our top rural health issues, and these get identified by our membership as well as our advocacy committee and board of directors. None of these should be a surprise to you, but some of them will differ from perhaps priorities in urban areas. Rural health insurance market changes. We appreciate your action, by the way, on House File 1, Senate File 1. It was a very important immediate step needed to make health care coverage more affordable and accessible to people. But we also recognize that there's a whole need for systemic long-term reform in our health insurance markets. And we ask you to pay careful attention to the impacts to rural. It's very important. There are less options out there. And again, with the lower income and the thinner margins, what you do that might work in the metro area could in fact get perpendicular with things in rural areas. Access to behavioral health is a huge issue, and dental care as well. Opioid abuse and treatment, a top priority in rural areas. It is an epidemic. We have too many people dying, too many people ending up in hospitals with opioid abuse problems. Non-emergency medical transportation. How do you get people to the things they need in order to age and live healthy in place in rural communities that are often much separated from those needs and services? Broadband shortages and that impact on telemedicine. We need to continue pushing that. Telemedicine is an outstanding way for us to get expert health resources into rural areas of our state. There's also telemonitoring and a number of other technologies dependent on broadband that help us keep people healthy in place in rural communities. It's very important. Rural SHIP projects, the State Health Improvement Program projects, we would like to see more support for those. Reimbursement disparities are always an issue. As I mentioned, Medicare and Medicaid impact that to a certain extent. The reimbursement rates are lower for those programs, and we have people with a greater dependence on those in rural Minnesota. Hospitals, clinics, nursing homes in crisis, they have a much thinner margin, as you'll see. And then social determinants of health, the things that are not directly health care or health related, but that impact our health and well-being. So insurance market changes. As I mentioned, thank you for passing House File 1, Senate File 1. And again, we still need systemic fixes to the insurance marketplace, particularly in rural areas, because so many rural Minnesotans are facing absolutely unaffordable situations. More rural Minnesotans remain uninsured than in urban areas. Greater percentages of rural Minnesotans rely on public programs, as I've mentioned, and that creates its own dynamics and pressure on facilities and providers. Restricted plan availability and narrow networks, so narrow networks of providers, make it more difficult for people to access the care they need in an affordable way. We need sustainable, long-term, affordable solutions in rural communities. Healthcare workforce shortages. We could draw these bars endlessly because there are so many shortages in rural areas. Ask anybody who lives out there, those of you who represent rural districts, you know what I'm talking about. Some of the key ones, primary care, mental and behavioral health care, dental care, obstetrics, home health care, both at lower complexities and higher complexities, pharmacy and medication therapy management, and language interpreters, as I mentioned, the growing diversity in rural Minnesota. Just for an example, to narrow in on one measure, the population per primary care physician. In the metro, you've got about 965 people to every one primary care physician. And as you see, as you move out to rural, small town, small rural, over 1,000 per doc. And in rural isolated areas of our state, close to 3,000 people per primary care provider, or per primary care doc physician. So what are we doing about that? Well, the Minnesota residency slots right now have remained flat. If you look at 2004 to 2016, the uptake of those positions is 100%, but we're not creating new residency positions. We're aware of a number of efforts to try to improve that, to try to create more training opportunities for physicians, and then to try to get some of those to rural areas, but we're not hitting the mark yet. So we need more action at both the federal and state level to address our desperate need for primary care physicians and other healthcare providers for rural areas. So emerging professions. We know that the whole scope of practice issue is an area of healthcare reform right now, and we have other people available to help out with the work, particularly in rural areas. So you see that we have community health workers, dental therapists, community paramedics, doulas. and mental health peer support specialists, all helping out with the heavy lifting in rural areas that might have been done only by much more highly trained or certified or licensed professionals in the past. We need to keep going with that. Opioid abuse and treatment. Minnesota saw a 500% increase in deaths related to opioid abuse between 1999 and 2014. 338 Minnesotans died of opioid overdoses in 2015. It's a particular epidemic for rural areas. The treatment options are scarce. And our association has been part of efforts to promote education about proper disposal of prescription opioids because, frankly, one of the biggest paths to opioid abuse right now is through your medicine cabinet. It's the undisposed of opioids, painkillers, that are creating a big part of the problem. Medical and non-medical transportation. So you're dealing with greater distances between things that you need in rural areas. And that creates a problem. You don't always have public transit opportunities like you do in the urban areas. So for seniors who require door-to-door rides, for example, there are often no options other than volunteers, friends, family, neighbors, and volunteer organizations, faith-based organizations, trying to fill the gaps, trying to get people to what they need to keep them healthy in place. I mentioned broadband shortage and telemedicine. It's more than just telemedicine. You know, the Telemedicine Act was very helpful in 2015. But we've got telemental health visits that can be very helpful if we could get more broadband access. Teleeducation, telemonitoring, robotic assistance, and other things that help keep people healthy in place in rural communities. So major portions of rural Minnesota still don't have the broadband access necessary to do that well. And I mentioned the Telemedicine Act, which has been helpful, but we need to expand it. The caps on telehealth visits and the limits on the providers who can use it are barriers to getting these resources out to rural areas. Reimbursement disparities. Again, heavy reliance on public health care programs that typically pay below cost, and we see those programs pushing for lower reimbursement. And the unaffordability factor of premiums with high deductibles, neural networks, and other barriers when it comes to health insurance and health coverage. Hospitals, clinics, and nursing homes in crisis. Hospitals operating in the red or with margins of less than 5% in rural communities. Again, the Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement factor. And all of those facilities experiencing significant financial stress despite what we've been able to do for nursing homes, long-term care facilities in the last couple of years. The social determinants of health I mentioned. So again, Department of Health defining those as created by decisions that affect community or society at large. And we have those factors impacting rural communities more than urban communities. Our mission as an association to strengthen and improve Minnesota's rural health and health care through leadership, education, advocacy, and collaboration. We would love to have all of you come to the Minnesota Rural Health Conference. It is the premier health, rural health event of the year, June 19th and 20th this year at the DEC in Duluth. And with that, I'll thank you. I know that our board president, Todd Lemke, has additional comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep. Thank you very much. I very much appreciate the ability to talk, so thank you. The Minnesota Rural Health Association really works very hard to help promote and support and be the voice of rural health for Minnesota. Our policy committee did a very good job coming up with these recommendations, and I can just give you some examples from my health system that I work with through CentraCare, where we see a lot of these situations. Mental health is something that we use very strongly in our area. We had telemental health at one point, but those providers stopped being available for telemental health. So we have big gaps in our service. People have to travel long distances in order to see a provider. There's still very large gaps in health insurance. People are paying large deductibles, choosing not to pay for products that they really need, services that they need. And so we see that every day. I'm the director of pharmacy, and through our critical access hospital. In the last month, we've given out about $2,000 worth of medications, just for free, just to people that can't afford their medications. There are programs out there that assist us in being able to do that. The 340B program is something that helps. But it does, everything is something that, if we can have programs out there to help these people fill those gaps, that's the best for us. As far as providers, we're not only having problems getting primary care providers. We're also having problems getting nurses, LPNs, CNAs, those types of things. The Minnesota Rural Health Association has had conversations with many health systems and looking at talking with schools to look at how can we get the right people out at the right time as far as education. And so those are some of the things that we asked that you continue to look at as very important things to improve the health for our communities. So I very much thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we also have Mark Schoenbaum from the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Schoenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Mark Schoenbaum from the Health Department. I won't take much of your time. I just want to say that from where we sit, having a partnership with the Minnesota Rural Health Association works very well. It's something that's very important to us. There are state offices of rural health and state rural health associations in states across the country. Some of them have this kind of close partnership, some of them don't. So I think something that we can all be proud of is that we've got kind of within government and outside of government this collaboration on what we all know are these important issues at the health department. We are also advised by a rural health advisory committee, 15 members appointed by the governor. Representative Schumacher represents you on that committee. Those thought leaders see the issues almost precisely the same way that the association does, and so I think they would say ditto to everything that you've heard this afternoon. I think you all know we're a resource to you, so just wanted to second what you heard today. And I'll leave it at that.
Okay. So, Mr. Lemke or Mr. Gottwald, on your slide deck, I just have a couple of questions maybe you could expand on.
Certainly.
Mr. Gottwald, you mentioned one of the slides, it's on average rural Minnesotans are less healthy. It's the worst health problems were found in rural parts of our state. So could you expand on what worst health problems are typical? What are we facing in terms of maladies out there?
Well, you know, you talk about, Mr. Chair, in response, I don't have the entire study in front of me, but you do talk about, you know, kind of the major baskets of illness or unhealth, things like diabetes, cardiac conditions, cancers. And we have a higher incidence of a lot of those kinds of things going on in rural Minnesota. Part of it is access to the other services. So these social determinants of health care impact this as well. But on a number of measures, I'd be glad to forward a copy of the study to you, but on a number of these measures, people perform worse in those counties that you see on this map that are darker. We also have an older population. Let's face it, as we age, we need more health care. We have more illness, and so that impacts it as well.
Yeah, I think you'll see in northern Minnesota, some of the ethnic populations are there. You'll see a greater incidence of diabetes and heart disease and certain other conditions as well. And also exposure, if you look at that part of the state, they may have been in the past been exposed to mining and different other chemicals that during the mine process could have been put them at risk to these types of diseases.
You mentioned in a couple subsequent slides on the insurance market changes, and you touched on the utilization factor for Medicaid, and we've obviously seen that at the state level with the ramp up in terms of the amount that it becomes to absorb within our budget. And I'm just wondering if that's a function of utilization by the broad demographic, or is it a utilization by individuals as they get closer and closer to end-of-life issues? wonder if you have any ability to expand on that.
Well, Mr. Chair, the impact of Medicare and Medicaid in rural is a function of demographics primarily. You have an older population, so more people on Medicare. You have a poorer population, more people on Medicaid. And because those programs pay less than, for example, commercial payers, the hospitals and clinics in rural Minnesota are seeing more of those people. And you add to that the insurance situation that we faced recently that really impacted rural communities even more intensely than it did urban. You have three counties in north central Minnesota that had no option whatsoever during open enrollment this year. So you have people less able to afford those things, being able to get their own coverage. They show up at clinics and hospitals and increase the uncompensated care. The ACA was meant to kind of reduce uncompensated care. What we've seen from a lot of our rural hospitals in particular is they've seen this actually impact them to a greater extent now because people have insurance, but they don't have coverage. So if you've got a $10,000, $13,000 deductible you can barely afford, you're not going to be able to walk in and pay the hospital or pay the clinic. They're going to end up bearing the burden of that. And we see that a lot in rural communities.
Mr. Gottwald, you said there was three counties that were not available to a network during open enrollment.
You know, Morrison, Todd, and I believe Mille Lacs were the three.
Thank you. Representative Murphy, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a few questions, and I'm grateful for this information and am eager for more. So I'd like to just touch base on broadband, on workforce, and then on the healthcare delivery system. And between you and the Department of Health, maybe you can help us dig down a little further so we can understand this a little bit better. So one of the slides in the deck talks about broadband and it being a major barrier to delivery. And I might not have those words right. I think there's been a lot of discussion in the last number of years about broadband. I'm in making sure we're reaching everyone or everyone has access. But I don't remember in the last couple of years this committee talking specifically about the distribution of broadband or where we are weak or bare. So if you were able to share that information with us but through your lens of healthcare, that would help us, I think, better understand the value of or the possibility of telemedicine. If that's okay. Is it okay if I just ask these questions in a row? Okay. When I think about workforce and attracting a workforce to greater Minnesota, we obviously have the fact that we know that healthcare providers across the state are going to retire, and that's going to hit greater Minnesota more than it's going to hit the urban core because of the distribution of the aging population. When I worked in a rural hospital, it was a tertiary care hospital, so it was a big hospital, and it attracted nurses and residents and doctors, but they didn't stay there that long because they didn't necessarily want to live there, which I think is one of the questions for us when we think about the workforce. So I'm interested in not just, what we're doing to attract people to come into the healthcare professions, but if you have the ability to show us across the state the distribution of where the shortages actually exist. And I am wondering about the intersection between communities that are thriving in greater Minnesota, the ones that are, they got their game face on and they're doing a great job, and they may have a concentration of a healthcare delivery system or a network, but also there's something happening in that community that is drawing people to it. Is that a place that holds healthcare workforce? Do healthcare workers, nurses, doctors, et cetera, go there to practice? And are there other parts of the state that are really suffering from shortages? And is there a connection to the healthcare delivery system, or is it about the community itself?
There's a lot in there, Mr.
There is.
So.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we could actually spend a couple of meetings going over all the workforce challenges in rural and where the spots are, the gaps are, where we're succeeding, where we're not. Mr. Schoenbaum, I think, too, could share some of the strategies we're using. It's everything from scrubs camps, trying to get people. So, for example, young people going to a high school in a rural community. They've grown up there. They love rural life. They're more likely to stay there if we give them a pathway to a healthcare profession. We're trying to do more of that, trying to get into the high schools early and give people exposure to the possibility of, you know, if you go to school and you become an RN or an MD or whatever it is you want to be in healthcare, there's going to be a job for you. We want to be able to show them that. There's going to be good reimbursement for you. We want to be able to show them that. A good lifestyle for you and your spouse and your kids. It's a good move. So we're trying to do some of that. We're also paying attention to new Americans. So we have people coming to our state from other countries who already have medical training. And as I mentioned, in rural areas, you may not think there's a lot of diversity, but we actually have growing diversity there and people coming from other areas. Are there some ways we can reduce the regulatory red tape and do some things to help get those people into our health system, providing care sooner and better? Those are just a couple of things we're trying to do. The larger metro areas clearly are doing better. The regional centers in rural Minnesota tend to be able to attract more because the resources are there. And so it is more of a challenge in the lesser populated parts of rural Minnesota. It kind of makes sense. But it is a struggle. It's a struggle even with the large health systems. Mr. Lemke here is with Centricare, one of the large rural health systems based out of St. Cloud. And it is a real challenge to find people everywhere from, you know, PCAs and home health aides all the way up to surgeons or, you know, doctors and everything else, ancillary providers. It's not easy. And how we turn that corner, how we attract enough people or grow enough of our own, there's just so many challenges and so many strategies being discussed right now.
Yeah, I would agree. I think, you know, some of the areas that you might see some the biggest shortages are in long-term care and the home health agencies, because they're not able to be able to afford to pay people at rates compared to like a St. Cloud hospital in our area. And so, and even at my small critical access hospital, we often are kind of the stepping stone for people to move up, just because St. Cloud, which is about 40 minutes away, they'll have sometimes a pay rate of $10 more an hour. And so people drive at 40 minutes for that rate. And so we end up being a little short-handed sometimes.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that. And I know I'm asking a complex question, and you might not be able to slice and dice up the data that you have to be able to answer it. And hearing ideas that I think are important in terms of pipeline and preparation, right? How do we prepare a workforce? And I think we have to pay attention to that. And there have been lots of attempts and efforts to, you know, put money into scholarships and grant programs, et cetera. I think we also need to look at the retention issue, right, and the intersection between the community and the work. And I know that's outside the jurisdiction of this committee, but I'm hoping that the work that you're doing and the work that's being done at the Department of Health can shed some light on that for us. So it can inform us, because in the next 10 to 15 years, right, we're going to see this generational shift in a workforce retiring. People are already worrying about it in greater Minnesota. Who's going to be here to take care of us? You know, if we don't have a hospital or a clinic, what happens to my community, right? So it's a pretty urgent issue for us. And I would love your help in trying to understand that a little better. So, you know, if it means going offline and talking about it, that's fine. But I think it's important. The other thing I want to say when we talk about the slide deck is the social determinants of health. And I'm grateful to see them embedded here. I think if we were to look at social determinants of health, which I do think are, there's a correlation between a straight line between that and people's health, that we would see a statewide issue, right? That there is scarcity and barrenness in the urban core in terms of access, in terms of health, just like there is in greater Minnesota. And it's one of those things that bridges our divisions. And it's bridging our divisions in a way that's not so great because we're talking about a lack of health. But I think, you know, if we're going to talk about social determinants of health, we should think about the whole state in addition to what you're talking about here, because I think it drives a better picture for us of the state of Minnesota and probably shifts our interventions a little bit in a way that will be helpful if health is our goal.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I so much appreciate that. And the reason we're doing this in front of this committee is that this is a tidal wave coming at us. I think Representative Murphy touched on it briefly. We have a shortage right now. So Department of Human Services, just in direct care, non-licensed direct care, estimates we're going to need 60,000 more people. We're at a shortage of 60,000 by 2020. And we're experiencing it right now. There are bills in the legislature right now that are trying to figure out how do we get more trained people to deliver care where we're failing to deliver it. Thousands of hours of care that aren't being delivered because we don't have people to do it. And then if you look ahead to the people who are retiring and leaving, it gets really desperate. And it's going to have a serious financial impact on Minnesota in the area of health and human services. So it's kind of all hands on deck. We really do need people to step up. We need you to understand this as you address various approaches to meeting the healthcare needs in Minnesota, both urban and rural. I agree there is no, there shouldn't be a sense that it's one versus the other. The urban needs are important, so are the rural needs, and they are different. I think that's the point we make, is that it is different in rural. Love to put you all on a bus and take you out to some of the communities and show you the differences. We can't do that right now, but maybe we'll do that someday.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you've put your finger on the crisis that's coming, that's for sure. In my district, they're looking at opening an osteopathic medical school mm-hmm. with private money. I don't know if you're aware of it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's the, it would train 150 students per class for 4 years and then place them in rural residencies. That should be an incentive. For the most part, it's privately funded. They do want a few guarantees, but it seems like it's moving forward. It's in a small town, and it's specifically targeted towards the rural area. Now, I talked to some doctors in my district from a neighboring community, a little larger, and they seemed resistant to this school and didn't really think it was going to help that much. I still need to do some, I wrote a letter of support, so did my senator, and have been involved in trying to promote it as much as possible. But can you give any insight as to solutions like this? Are they going to address the need? And why would medical doctors, even after talking to them, we happen to be at an event where I get a chance to talk to two or three of them, they just didn't seem very supportive of that for some reason.
Mr. Gutwell.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen, it's a good question. We're very familiar with the Minnesota College of Osteopathic Medicine proposal for Gaylord, Minnesota. The problem isn't organizations willing to train new people. It's that in order to get somebody from a student level to a doctor level, whether it's a doctor of osteopathy or an MD or whatever, you've got to have residencies and you've got to have preceptorships. The federal government caps our residencies because they're expensive, $200,000 per residency. And so CMS at the federal level looks at that and says, boy, we've got to keep this budget tight. We need more funding for residencies. That's part of the solution, both urban and rural.
Mm-hmm.
And so the concern with some of these efforts, and it's not just the school in Gaylord, but other efforts to create medical schools, if you will, is that once you get these students in and you get them trained, it's very expensive for them to go to school. Do you have the pipeline, the pathway for them to get the preceptors and the residencies to become actual practicing providers that we can plug into the need? And right now that's not the case. So you end up kind of robbing from Peter to pay for Paul, in a sense. There's a limited number of residency slots. They're already being taken up by our existing medical schools. We need more providers. So we really need more opportunities for students to get residences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so that's more like a federal level fix, obviously.
It is. Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, it really is, at least in part, federal. I think states can play a role in encouraging our congressional delegation and CMS to give us more opportunity there. I think it's something where you need to be advocates. As representatives of the people of the state of Minnesota, we're trying to raise that awareness so that we get more people pushing the federal government to change that. This is something that state offices of rural health and state rural health associations like ourselves are making a big priority in D.C. right now.
Okay.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in my community, we do have an issue with opioid abuse like we're seeing in across our state and other states, so I'm glad you brought that up in your presentation. And we have about a 5 to 7 week waiting period to get into treatment for opioid abuse and other controlled substance abuse. And I'm wondering if you can share with us any ideas on what we can do at the state level to try to address that shortage and the long waiting time.
Mr. Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, thanks for the question. You know, it is a real challenge, and as I've mentioned, it's kind of all hands on deck. How do you get somebody with the training of a psychologist or a psychiatrist to live in a rural area? One of the answers that we see is that telemedicine, and that gets back to the broadband shortage issue, the opportunity for us to take expert resources like highly trained psychologists, psychotherapists, psychiatrists, and extend them out into a rural community so that perhaps through broadband you could meet a crisis situation and prevent it from becoming a hospitalization or an incarceration or something much, much worse. How can we get out there, stabilize the situation, and then get those people to resources, treatment resources that they need? So the shortage is real. We're hoping that technology might help us at least meet some of the immediate need and keep things from getting extreme or worse before that happens. Now, how do you get more providers out there? That's a huge challenge. I'm not sure that I have the answer.
Mr. Lund.
One thing that we often kind of fail to remember is that, you know, opioid addiction is kind of a disease or a state, and we sometimes try to treat it differently. I think there are often times that you can create treatment protocols that you do not always have to have a specialist running, or you can have other people within the healthcare system at different levels running these treatment protocols. So I think looking at that as an option would also reduce it. The time that it takes to put a person into a program.
Follow-up, Representative Schultz.
Thank you for that testimony. I'm very concerned about it, so I hope other committee members are aware of this issue that we have in getting folks, when they're ready, to address their addiction in the treatment, because timing is everything.
Final comments for Mr. Gottwald or Mr. Lemke.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you very much for this opportunity. I think you can see these issues they're critical and they're urgent. They're not the sorts of things we can keep sweeping under the rug, and I'm not suggesting anybody is, but as a state, we really need to come to grips with this and start doing a good job of providing efficient and effective solutions. The Minnesota Rural Health Association and its members are ready to help with that heavy lifting, and we're ready to provide any information that any of you might need and be part of the solution. We appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Members, we are going to move to House File 1061. Representative Zerwas moves House File 1061 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Representative Zerwas, we have the bill before us. To your bill. And I understand that you do have a testifier.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. I'll just do a very brief introduction. The Home and Community-Based Services Incentive Pool is a program that we've seen before in this committee, and we've codified in years past. It's a competitive grant program where requests for proposals aim to achieve three outcomes: competitive employment, integrated housing options, and community integration. The first RFP set innovative solutions to achieving outcomes in competitive employment, integrated housing options, and community integration. 27 proposals were received, and 10 proposals were funded. The second RFP requested a vendor to administer micro grants for people with disabilities to achieve individual outcomes related to employment, housing, and community. Three proposals were received, and one vendor that hasn't been released yet has been selected. And then the third RFP will soon to be released, and that will cultivate innovative and creative responses from a variety of applicants that change into plain language. Applications are designed to encourage a broad group to focus in on this new state RFP and grant process. So we're trying to open the doors even wider. From the first phase of the RFPs, we do have one of the executive directors of one of the grant awardees here to talk about their program. But I'll turn it over to the testifier.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lynn Noren, and I'm from RISE Incorporated. We're a community organization that provides supports to people who have disabilities and other types of economic disadvantages. Our services are provided throughout the Twin Cities metropolitan area and across central Minnesota. They primarily focus on employment and community inclusion types of services. I'm here today in support of increasing funding for the Home and Community-Based Services Incentive Pool with the Department of Human Services. We'd like to thank Representative Zerwas for leading these efforts in the last several years, and also to the co-authors, Representatives Schumacher, Murphy, Hoverson, Dean, and Albright. The incentive pool was part of the governor's proposal in 2015. The competitive RFP helps disability providers like RISE to demonstrate what they know can work, but haven't been able to implement due to challenges within the rates, the current rate system. Providers are focused on community options for people, but can only go so far in transitioning services based on our current funding structures. This competitive RFP is available to disability service providers who are eager to innovate, to move more people with disabilities into greater independence. Again, like Representative Zerwas says, the three different areas they're focused on are competitive employment, independent living, and greater community integration. RISE received an award from the HGBS Incentive Pool for $150,000 to assist people with complex and significant disabilities in obtaining competitive employment. The innovative way this grant works for us is by offering payment only for successful program outcomes. We are paid when people that we serve achieve certain milestones, such as being hired on a job. Another payment happens when they're retained in that employment for 90 days. And again, the third and final payment is at 180 days of retention. The primary reason we couldn't provide this service previously and why providers are so often unable to innovate in day services especially is that competitive and community employment services today, the current rate methodologies for persons served under the Medicaid waivers are really insufficient to cover the costs of these services. Additionally, we really believe that testing performance-based payment models will provide key learning for all of us as we work in the future to try and determine future reimbursement models. This grant is divided into three areas. The first were proposals for over $50,000, like those that are listed in your handout. The second was for a vendor to administer the micro-grants for people with disabilities to achieve individual outcomes. And the third grant is for proposals under $50,000 to cultivate small grants and micro-grants to promote innovative and creative responses from a variety of applicants, some of whom may be new to the state RFP process. For the first round of grants, there were 27 applicants requesting a total of $7 million, and only 10 applicants were awarded the $1.7 million that was available and that you see on your list. Each project details the specific benchmark they will be working to meet to receive the incentives that can then be invested back into moving to the next person. We're really thrilled that these grants are creatively designed to be available directly to people who have disabilities. We'd like to achieve specific outcomes as well. We don't know yet what those grants would look like, but they could be for things like ongoing education for individuals, to be able to learn a trade or learn skills that might help them become more independent, or grants to help them start a business. It's a very exciting part of this grant process. Many of these projects will be especially advantageous to youth with disabilities. Supporting youth and others with disabilities to perhaps bypass living in a group home or being involved in a day training and rehabilitation setting is exciting and a new and innovative way to look at their services. Supporting people moving right into independent living and competitive employment would be critical in turning the ship of disability services to great independence. So I really want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on behalf of the bill? Members, any discussion? Any final comments, Representative Zerwas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just finally, as was mentioned, in the first round of grant applications, there was $7 million in applications out of the first round for a little over $1 million available. So certainly the need is here, and I hope the committee considers this program. With that, I'll renew my motion, Mr. Chair.
With that, House File 1061 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Members, before we adjourn, our next meeting is going to be next Tuesday, February 21st. At that meeting, we will be hearing a presentation by the OLA's office on their evaluation report for home and community-based services, their financial oversight. DHS has also been invited to respond to that report. The copies of the report will be available at 9 a.m. on Tuesday, either on the OLA's website or at their office. And with that, members, we are adjourned.